Jim, we're going to get started here. Good afternoon. Today is April 29th, 2015, and we're opening up the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on General Government, and we're opening up a public hearing on House Bill 5035. My co-chair, Senator Stiwart Hayward, is the co-chair today, and so when she comes, I'll be tossing the gavel over to her. But in the interest of time, I wanted to get our committee open. As we start off, John, let me turn to you. Is there anything we need to be thinking about as we get ready for the director from the Department of Revenue?
Co-chair, member of the subcommittee. No, this is just really a specific follow-up on their phase one discussion that's limited to their collection activities, and specifically what is the agency's responsibility for collections within the liquidated delinquent account.
Perfect. Thank you. So, Mr. Director, I'm going to turn this over to you, and I'll let you make the introductions as you deem necessary.
Terrific. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Jim Buchholz, Director of your Department of Revenue. As John said, today will be about addressing a number of issues related to our business. John was kind enough to give us a list of topics and questions that the committee was interested in hearing more about, and we'll try to address those today. Some of the questions are fairly high level, and some of them are fairly specific, and so we'll approach this on a tag team basis. I'll start out by addressing some of the more high level questions, and I'll turn it over to staff to address some of the more program specific issues. So go ahead. Deanna, are you driving? Okay, you got it. Thank you. Okay, this is a modified chart that comes from the June 30th, 2014 LFO delinquent and liquidated accounts receivable report. I think you're probably all familiar with that report that summarizes the debt that's owed to the state. And this chart shows the top 10 agencies by total accounts receivable outstanding. And we've added another line that adds the others not in the top 10 to get to the $3.2 billion total as of the end of the 2014 fiscal year. You can see that DOR is number two on that list. Our delinquent debt that we reported to the LFO in this report was $757 million at the end of 2014. And so we have responsibility for about 24% of that $3.2 billion total. Mm-hmm. But even though our part is only about one quarter of the total, we own by far and away the largest percentage of that that represents general fund. And so most of the $3.2 billion is dedicated other funds. Our slice represents nearly 95% of that general fund debt. And many of these agencies also contract with us to collect their debt through our other agency accounts function. And Deanna is going to speak to that in a few moments. So on this slide, this next slide, no, you're one ahead. There we go. This simply shows the prior table in a graphical way, showing DOR's tax debt portion of the total, as well as the portion of the other agency's debt that was reported in the LFO report that we're collecting through OAA. Now go ahead. This chart shows the accounts receivable balances over the past 10 years, and it shows both the statewide accounts receivable debt. You can see that's the green line that gets up to the $3.2 billion as of the end of 2014, and the orange line is DOR's portion of that that represents the tax debt. So in the orange roughly equates to the general fund portion of that debt that's owing, so we wanted you to see this. Incidentally, we got a request late this morning for some additional information, and that is posted to OLIS. And what we have are the for the last 10 years, the accounts receivable balances by tax program. So there's one chart that shows all of them together, and it's.
You want me to pull that up?
Do you want to pull that up?
Mm-hmm.
This would be the place. We didn't have time to incorporate it into the slide deck. There we go. Okay, this shows the entire tax debt the entire debt that we owed for each of those programs that you see off to the right. And because personal income tax dominates the scale, because that's so much larger, we have another one for you, if you can scroll down, that shows the same detail without personal income tax so that you can see the individual data. These are the accounts receivable balance as of 2005 through 2014 for each of the programs that we collect for. So now if we can go back to the other. And that's in OLAS. Next slide, if you can. Here we go. So liquidated and delinquent. Liquidated and delinquent has a very specific definition in this LFO report. And we report our debt as close as we can to meeting these definitions. But there's an important distinction to tax debt that I think I need to make here. Liquidated for purposes of the report is in essence debt where the exact amount of the debt is fixed and known to the debtor. And delinquent means the debt is past due. The tax debt that we report in many cases is not necessarily fixed. So we report it as liquidated and delinquent, but it's not necessarily liquidated. And maybe the clearest example of this that I can give you is in the filing enforcement assessments that we set up. One of the contributors to our tax debt comes from people who we think should have filed but didn't. And so if we can't get the taxpayer to file a return through our requests, we'll file an assessment or we'll set up an assessment on their behalf, saying this is what we believe they owe. And we base these assessments on the best information available as to what we believe their income is. But we typically are very conservative from our standpoint with regard to filing status and deductions. So we'll assume the taxpayer will file single or separate as opposed to a more favorable filing status. We'll assume the taxpayer will only be entitled to the standard deduction and without regard to assuming greater itemized deductions. And we also will add either a 50 or 100% penalty on the balance due, depending on the circumstance. And oftentimes, this assessment will get the taxpayer to stop ignoring us, and they'll finally begin to work with us. And in our process, the taxpayer is then allowed the opportunity to file what we call a true return. This is something that has their actual circumstances. And we'll reduce that assessment that we filed based upon the true return if we agree with it. And so sometimes our assessment is reduced by deductions that we didn't know about. Sometimes it's reduced by withholding that we didn't know about. And the tax debt then that we report in the LFO report is technically due and fixed in that the taxpayer will have been notified of the debt and their normal appeal rights will have expired.
So Jim, really quick, and I think I know the answer, but I still have to ask it just to get on the record. Are any of our state employees who are within your department, are any of them compensated on any form of commission as they're working through the collection process?
Mr. Chair, no. I think you probably get a number of them that wish they were.
Right.
But no, they're not.
Okay. So, I mean, so that it's really important, I think, for all of us to understand that, I mean, these folks are genuinely trying to get to the best reasonable solution for all.
We are. In fact, Mr. Chair, by statute, we're required, the assessments that we set up for these taxpayers, we're required to do them in good faith. So it has to be based on something. And we do base on the information that we have as best as we can. But we're conservative in what we allow the taxpayer. And part of that is a strategy on our part to get them to come to the table and work with us.
Thank you.
Okay.
Excuse me. Thank you, Senator Steiner-Hayward. How many people are you doing the assessments for? How many filers? I mean, how many do you have to do the assessment for them and then send it out to them? Approximately.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Taylor, I don't have. Do you? Well, we may have to get that.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Deanna Mack, also with the Department of Revenue. And I do know that many of the taxpayers that we engage with for filing enforcement purposes come to the table before we have to get to the actual assessment level. We send several letters. We send a request to file. We say, look, we're really serious about this. Please contact us. And then we get to the assessment. So there's several months in between where we work with them to get them to file a return before we get to that point. So my guess, and we'll get some actual numbers for you, but I think that that's not the majority, would be my guess. We get a lot of returns in the before we have to get to assessment, but they are filing enforcement returns, if that makes sense.
Yeah, a follow-up. I'm just trying to get an understanding of how effective the assessment, doing the assessment for folks, sending the letter as the assessment, what percentage of, how that all works. You know, what percentage of people are falling into that category that you believe are not paying, okay? And then you send the letters and say, hey, we're not kidding. Go ahead and pay what you are owe. And then as it goes along, how much people then start to pay, and then it gets down to we have to actually file the assessment, I mean, do the assessment for them and send it to them, and then they have the opportunity, as you said, to say, actually, I don't owe that much. This is what I owe. I'm trying to understand the effectiveness of that route. You understand, like, what percentage, how much is that, is it making, how much of a difference is it making?
Okay, Madam Chair, Representative Taylor, we can get you some numbers on that that might help you in that regard. I can tell you, and I was going to get into this in later part of my testimony, that over the last couple of years, 2013 and 2014, the filing enforcement assessments has been the largest addition to our tax accounts receivable. And I'll explain why I think that is a little bit later.
Thank you.
And I'm sorry, I was just coming in when you were getting to these slides and got hung up. If you go back to slide 4 for 1 second, that one, yeah. What did you talk at all about what you're attributing that huge rise for other state AR?
Madam Chair, we don't own that debt, so I am not an expert in the other parts of the state. I can tell you that at least for our purposes, when the Great Recession hit, people didn't have the same ability to pay. And so that's when the accounts receivable really started rising. And so my guess is that some of that same activity is happening for some of the other debt, but I don't know. I can't speak to it. I can speak to the tax part, the part that we own.
Okay. Senator Whitsitt.
That slide there and then the one previous, you have a huge amount of other agency debt that is in the black part there, the purple part, that is really unexplained. You know that we have $259 million that has been assigned to the Department of Revenue to collect, apparently. What happens to all the rest of it?
Mr. Chair, Deanna is going to get to that in about 30 seconds.
All right, I'll wait 30 seconds.
Okay.
So if I can just, before you do that, the point that I wanted to make on this is that we report our debt as delinquent and liquidated. But it's not necessarily liquidated. That it isn't necessarily fixed. That sometimes the debt that we pay or that we report in that will be reduced downward. And so that's the point that I want to make on that. So now go.
I just question. Just to be clear, thank you, Senator Steiner-Hayward. So you're saying that you're reporting a higher number, and because in that assessment, you're reporting a higher number, and then when folks actually go to file, it's often reduced.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And so do you report both then?
Madam Chair, Representative Taylor, we report, it's a snapshot as of June 30th of the year. So whatever debt we have that is fixed and liquidated for purposes of the report, we report to you.
Okay.
But in every year, there is some portion of that that gets revised downward because we have an ability to reopen that statute of limitations in order to reduce the debt.
Okay, follow up. Thank you. So the reason I'm asking is because I don't want it, because it could perceive not favorable for you that the number is larger when actually what people owe is less, right? So what percentage of a decline overall does it go down? Of everyone collectively, does it go down 3%, 10%, 20%?
Madam Chair, Representative Taylor, we're going to get to that in another slide.
Alrighty then. Sorry. Thank you.
You'll see the amount that we
abate. Alrighty. Thank you.
Okay, for the record, Deanna Mack with Department of Revenue, and I'm here to talk about our other agency accounts, and again, later on, I'll talk about some of the questions you guys had about our collections process generally. But for our other agency accounts, you wanted to know how it works, what agencies are using it, some of the amounts we have, and then why some agencies might not be using other agency accounts. So It was established by the legislature in 1971, and we're currently working with about 180 different agencies, including state agencies, boards, commissions, circuit and district courts, and educational, OHSU, several agencies like that. Generally, the statute requires that state agencies refer debt to either a private collection firm or the Department of Revenue within 90 days of no payment on the account. So there can't be any 90 days without a payment, and they have to refer it to one or the other. They don't have to do both, and there is no order of them. OAA does two services. They provide services for refund offset only. So we'll take the debt, and they can sit here and wait for us to process a tax refund, which we'll seize and apply to the debt. While that account is still sitting at a private collection firm, they can do that. It's kind of a tag team effort there. And then we also offer full collection services, which includes billing notices. We can get up into advanced collections like garnishment, etc. And that's in addition to refund offsets.
Sorry. Thank you.
This is really interesting. So on the variety of boards and commissions, I'm assuming these are a lot of our smaller agencies within the state.
Mr. Chair, if I can go back to the end of the slide, I can give you a quick snapshot. I brought in some extra information. I'm just going to scan all the way through the end to show you. You probably can't really see it here, but it says like Chemeketa Community College. This is the list of the client agencies they have, and I can email this to you too.
No, that's cool. That's cool.
But there are all kinds of agencies that we work with.
So here's my question on that. That's cool to know. When we serve in that capacity on their behalf, I'm assuming the letter's going out from the Oregon Department of Revenue to these folks?
Mr. Chair, that is correct.
And then do we spell out in that letter that we're doing it on behalf of, in this case, Chemeketa Community College?
Mr. Chair, that is absolutely correct. And we actually often refer them back when they do call with questions about our collection letters. We have to refer them back to the client agency because they're the ones that have the underlying debt and the information about the municipal fine or the ticket or the parking ticket or whatever it is that we're collecting on, just like a private collection firm.
How does that work? I mean, let's say I have a delinquent owing at Chemeketa and I receive the letter. In the letter, does it direct me to call the community college or to contact the Department of Revenue?
Mr. Chair, it tells you, just like a private collection firm letter would say, that you have the ability to dispute the debt. You can contact the underlying agency to do that, because we are acting just like, in many cases, just like a private collection firm. We're collecting on behalf of the state. So we don't know the nature of the underlying debt necessarily, and we can't. There's no appeals for us. We can't appeal it for them or handle any appeal on that. We don't report this debt. The underlying agency reports the debt to the LFO for the reports. So there's some differences between, but we're very much like just a collection agency working on this debt for the state.
Follow-up question?
Please.
And again, this is 101 to me, okay? So I'm learning here. So with my question. If I was a private collection agency, I'm getting paid a commission. So I'm going to have more incentive to flex a little more, you know, or to harangue the person a little more to try and get the money back. What muscle do we use other than sending out a letter to get these people to respond? Because again, if I understand correctly, our folks aren't on that commission basis.
Representative Smith, that's correct. We don't have a commission basis with other agency accounts, and we have a requirement to send the account back to the referring agency if we can't get payment within a year. And the private collection firms don't have that same constraint. They can keep it quite a bit longer. And
right.
That's one of the things I talk about a little bit later on the slides.
Okay.
We have different tools than they have, and we complement each other a lot in what we do, and we're learning more about the things that they're good at and things that we're good at. And so often agencies will send an account to us to do work, and then we send it back to them, and then they send it out to a PCF to do more work because we have different tools.
I have one follow-up.
Sure.
And then I'm going to listen more.
Okay.
I'm probably going to answer a lot of this, so I apologize if I'm getting that. Statutorily, do you have the authority to withhold an income tax return if another agency, one of the variety of boards and commissions, owes us money? Do you have the ability to withhold that return, pay that off, and send the balance on to them?
Representative Smith, we do have in 293-250 authority and an expectation that if we have if the debtor has an income tax refund due to them, that we seize it and pay that debt that's due to the other state agency. If they don't already have personal income tax debt that offsets, then it'll come over to us. And that's awesome. The offset only program that sometimes people call it restricted because we don't do full collections on it, but that's what we do.
Okay, so I just want to make sure I'm clear. I don't mean to take up time. I just really want to understand it.
Yep.
So I owe Chemeketa Community College. They're one of our contractual boards and commissions. I owe them $500. I've got a return for $1,000. You folks can take that $500, make sure Chemeketa's paid off, and then assume there's no other balance, I get the remaining $500.
Representative, that's exactly right. And
that's
we
awesome.
Actually give them appeal rights to say we didn't take it properly and allow them, like maybe it's a spouse's refund or something like that. We absolutely work with them on that. But we do absolutely do that.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
Thank you, Senator Steiner here. So I do have one quick question about this. It says the goal is $110 million. And over 24 months, just here on my little calculator, that's $4.5 million a month. What is the actual amount out there to be collected? I see that that's the goal to collect it. What's the amount to be collected?
Well,
did I steal your thunder there?
Madam Taylor, well, I'll go ahead and skip to the next slide.
Okay.
Because you have a lot of information on this slide.
Okay.
Just the last point on the slide is that we are scheduled, this OAA is scheduled for implementation in CSR in the fall of 2016.
Before we leave that slide, what is the $12 million received from customers?
Okay. If Madam Chair, Representative Taylor, if I can get to your question on the next slide, I'll get to this slide first, if that's all right.
Yeah.
So, Madam Chair and Representative Whitsitt, the $12 million there is OAA is nonprofit and it's self-funding. So we've calculated a rate that we charge to our client agencies for our cost to collect, and that's where it comes from. Now the statute prevents us from making a profit on it. So if we do estimate our costs too high, then we rebate that money. We figure out what the overage is, and we rebate it back to our client agencies. Okay, and that's what that $12 million represents.
So really quick, before I do have one last question on this.
Of course you do. Go for it.
Federal tax intercept. Do you have? Talk to me about that. Talk to us about that.
Representative Smith, I have a whole slide on that.
A whole slide. Thanks.
Yeah, I've got a good 101 for you guys here today.
Okay. Perfect.
Okay. So back to Representative Taylor's question, and the LFO report has some of the debt that's reported that we collect on, but it doesn't report all of it. And again, Department of Revenue doesn't report this. The client agency reports it because it's their AR. But they send more debt over to us than is required to be reported in the LFO report. Some examples of that would be, for example, child support owed to a custodial parent that is not owed to the state, right? We collect that. Because it's a judgment and it's through so we do collect that. And then there's other agencies that are exempt from reporting, like OHSU. So that debt is in our balances, and the amount we collect, the $4.5 million or $4.25 million a month, but it isn't reported in the LFO report in total because it's exempt from being reported. And that, I think, goes to the slide in the LFO report. There's a page of agencies that are exempt from reporting in the LFO report itself to those numbers. Is that eye-opening?
Yeah, I think you can answer your follow-up because my question's aligned but not a follow-up, so go ahead, and then I'll ask my question. You looked like you had a follow-up.
Thank you, Chair Senator Hibbert. I was thinking that you and I were going to ask the same question.
Why are they exempt? Oh, that's a different question.
Madam Chair and Representative Taylor, there are different statutory reasons why they're exempt from reporting. DAS has an ability to grant exemptions from reporting. One of the most common ones that agencies use, I think, is bankruptcy. And I think it's in if you look at the LFO report, I do believe that there is a list of page 8 of the LFO report available, but it does show you the types of things that are exempt from collection. Most common are bankruptcy, any account that's in litigation, like probate, those kinds of things are exempt from being reported in the LFO report. Accounts that are less than $100 are exempt from being reported. And if there's a risk of loss of use of federal funds because it's reported, then they also are exempt from reporting. Those are the most common ones. And then there's some that are administratively exempt. And the most common one, I think, is spousal child support, which is also not required, and that's one of the big differences. And then DAS-approved exemptions. Like some agencies have specific issues that they think aren't liquidated necessarily, and so they don't send them in that report. So that's why our balance is substantially higher than what's reported in the other in the LFO report.
Okay, so my question was completely different, so it's good you asked yours. I'm struggling a lot with this slide for a whole host of reasons, and in no particular order, I'll ask you a couple questions.
Okay.
The first is, what's the aging on that debt? Like, is that all relatively new debt, or is some of that aged out, you know, 18 or 24 months, or that, I mean, $218 million from judicial, $56 million from OHSU and PERS together? Oh, those are the kinds of agencies?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
okay,
mm-hmm.
But still.
Yeah. Madam Chair, I can find out if we have access to the aging, but how old the debt is would be something that the client agency would have. I know once we get the debt, we have it for, we can have it for more than a year, but if we can't get a payment in a year, we send it back. So we don't, yep. We move it, but I don't know how old the debt is.
Okay, because I'm just thinking, I know we've talked about collections ad infinitum in this committee, so bear with me if I'm asking a question you've answered before, but 10% in terms of payments collected, but you weren't assigned all of that $334 million. You were only assigned 110 of that.
No, Madam Chair, that is the total debt we are assigned.
Oh.
Our collections on the previous slide, we have a biennial goal of collecting $110 million of that.
Okay.
Which is about 4.25 a month.
Okay, but so go back, now go to the next slide, but you only actually collected $36 million, which is about $3 million a month in fiscal year 2014. Or we're not quite done with...
Madam Chair, right. This is the total sum there is okay. 55,400,445, somewhere around there, between the offset and the total collections.
Add
on
the
that
two
side,
lower right-hand corners
add those
together.
Two together, and it sums to our goal, okay. Which is 110. But if you think about it, a lot of that debt is not necessarily spendable money. It's money that we have to send back to... you know, maybe the spouse or the child, the parent, custodial parent, that kind of thing.
But if it's a payment collected, it's a payment collected.
Correct.
And, okay, so this leads me to another question that I know I should know the answer, but can you explain one more time about the offset, what that really means? You know, it's learning a whole new language.
And
it takes me three times to learn something.
Madam Chair, offset is where we take the taxpayer's income tax refund and apply it to their outstanding debt. So the Department of Revenue side of the agency, the tax side of the agency, they'll send it to us.
So there's two ways of meeting that collection goal. One is you pick up the phone and say, dude, write me a check for X thousand dollars.
Just like that.
Exactly.
And the check's in the mail.
That's the script.
I'm sorry. It's just it's the time of year when I start to get a little punchy. And the other way is said dude sends his income tax in and is due a refund, and you say, not so fast. Correct. You still owe OHSU X thousand dollars, so we're only going to send you Y, which is the difference between what you owe OHSU and what... I got it.
Correct.
Okay.
Okay.
So Senator Whitsitt, and then Senator Johnson, and then Representative Taylor.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. The line labeled total there is its total amount of... other agency accounts that is currently assigned to you, and the next line down is the total amount of liquidated debt owed to the state that is not assigned to you, essentially.
No. Madam Chair and Representative, what's it that the 2.3, is that what you're looking at?
2.3 billion.
Yeah, that is sitting in our agency for offset only. So it could be duplicatively reported in the report. It could be at a private collection firm. It could be in the agency's AR, but that's what we call a restricted, and it's just sitting here waiting for a tax refund offset to be taken and posted against it.
The reason I brought it up is it is a very similar number to the number, go back to your third slide, other agencies, the $2.2 billion or 68% that is a liquidated delinquent balance that is not in your agency.
Is that the slide
yes.
you're referring to?
Mm-hmm.
Madam Chair and Representative, or Senator Whitson, I'm so sorry about that. The other agencies, again, it's a difference between the way it's reported. So we get all this debt from agencies, but the agencies aren't required to report it all to you. So those the numbers that our other agency accounts program can tell you about is not going to be the same story as what the LFO report will tell you.
So I guess my question is, and on that purple section there, is that debt that you have, that your agency has had at one time for a year or so and hasn't collected, or is it, and it's gone back to the agency?
Madam Chair, Senator Whitsitt, it absolutely could be that. It could be that.
Mm-hmm. But it could be a whole bunch of other things.
Could be
too.
All kinds of things.
And to go back to slide seven, that's, as I understand, that's an annual. Or biennial, we'd be doubling that year. Your goal is to collect $110 million. And you're collecting a total of 35 or 36 million and another 13 by offset. So you're collecting about 100 in 2 years.
Madam Chair and Senator Whitsitt, that is the goal is 110 million, and that is about half of it for the fiscal year.
Yes.
That's correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you're collecting about 100 or the 110 that you were after, which is pretty close.
Yeah, Madam Chair and Senator Whitsitt, we're about 81% of our goal right now, and we fully expect to meet that goal this year.
Yeah. Then, if you look for, you know, the first line there, the collection is about 10% of the judicial, about 8% of OHSU PERS, 23% of higher education, 10 or 11% of corrections, 7% of PERS. And the amount assigned to you is only $334 million. So how are you getting the... how are you getting to that number?
Yes.
On percentage wise.
Yeah.
$100 million would be a third or of the 334. But
Madam Chair and Senator Whitsitt, this is the fiscal year number, and the other number is a biennial number.
Mm-hmm.
Is that helpful?
We probably should talk about it offline because the numbers don't work for me. It's on
happy
a percentage basis.
Yeah, happy to do
yeah
that.
This is getting confusing. I had Senator Johnson next.
Oh, sorry.
Quick
sorry,
to
go
say
ahead.
About Representative
go
Senator Whitsitt. Okay, I'm getting so confused today. Senator Johnson, Representative Taylor, Co-Chair Smith.
I was just going to ask off the example that the chair gave you where there's a refund due. Are there any exemptions? Can you grab the entire refund, or do you have to make expense accommodation for mortgages or living expenses?
Madam Chair and Senator Johnson, the only item that's statutorily required to not be allowed to take is amounts for child support. If that makes sense. So, but we can take the whole refund if it's a joint return and the spouse on the return is not the debtor. That's what's called an injured spouse, and that spouse has a right to their share of the refund, and we do give that back to them. There's no other accounting for it.
That makes sense, but I think what's alarming to me, gazing over the charts that my colleague has, is that the number of the amount of the debt continues to rise, which suggests to me that there is a growing cohort of scofflaws. And it makes those of us that write our checks on April the 15th pretty angry that there is not an aggressive effort to collect this outstanding balances. I don't know whether or not you have explored what some people might consider draconian methodology. Some states publish the name of outstanding debtors on a website. I think you've got to do something to curtail this trend of people just deciding not to pay. It's completely unacceptable.
Madam Chair, Senator Johnson, I have information towards the end of my presentation. I don't know if we'll get to it today, but I'm happy to talk with you about some of the ideas that we're exploring for legislative concepts, including the public notification on websites. That's something we're exploring as well.
Explore so, quicker.
I could just interrupt for a second. As some of you know, we've asked Senator Whitsitt and Representative Taylor to work with the Department of Revenue on this issue, and I had a preliminary meeting with the two of them yesterday, and we are in ongoing conversations about exactly this issue, about how do we improve, help the Department of Revenue improve collections and figure out what statutory changes are needed, what requirements are needed, how we're going to work this all out. But this is high on my co-chairs and my priority list to facilitate your work in this direction, because frankly, I'm not interested in, I mean, when we're looking at the kinds of budget shortfalls we are and then we're leaving money on the table, it worries me.
And Madam Co-Chair, I would like to add that we, in part of the presentation today, I wanted to go over the tools that you've already given us, because we do have some pretty substantial tools, and many of you have had probably constituents come to your office and say, you know, Department of Revenue are big mean ogres, and so I have to explain to them what it is that the tools are that we're using. So I want you to understand, too, what the tools you've given us as well.
Well, I would personally say, having gotten one of these once because of a confusion about refunds, that when you get the words distraint warrant on a letter, it scares the living daylights out of you, because there's nothing like the word warrant to get your attention, even though a distraint warrant is something completely different from any other kind of warrant. Mm-hmm. But anyway, Representative Taylor.
Thank you. Maybe Mr. Borden, or you could, I think, to answer this. So a couple of times you've referenced the LFO or LRO report and how it differs than how you report. One of the issues I'm concerned about overall and what I'm learning about is that there's questions about transparency, and I don't think that the two of you go home at night and try to hide things from folks, but I don't want undue blame given either. So why is the reporting different, and is there room for improvement to make it so that everyone's talking the same language, the same information is being handed out, so we don't have things like, you know, if I understand you have a snapshot on that one day, but then there should be a follow-up later saying, oh, wait, but we actually, when people file, they owed less than that, so that it does not look like the Department of Revenue failed to collect a sum of money, because that's how it appears at first blush. So I'm trying to understand why there's the differences in reporting with the requirements, and is there something that needs to be changed in either? It's welcome to chime in on that.
Madam Chair, Representative Taylor, the main difference, again, there's two distinct components of Department of Revenue. One is the tax debt part, and we report to LFO on that component. The other agency accounts that we collect for, we do not report to LFO on, because the underlying agency, our client agency, reports to them. Mm-hmm. And then again, in their report, they have a list of the reasons why agencies do not report to them in their 2014 report. And there are a number of reasons that they don't report, or the fact that the statute exempts the agency entirely. So that is something that can be, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong on that, John. I think that's understanding in my report. And I think that LFO does a pretty good job of outlining that. It's really convoluted, I agree, but that is the nature of the LFO report and the accounts receivable as it's reported by the different agencies.
Thank you. I understand that. Mm-hmm. It's the whole point of it being convoluted that's causing concern, and it's making people think that work that needs to be done is not getting done. Mm-hmm. So it seems to me common sense-wise that we should be working towards eliminating that confusion, so that we're all discussing the same language and then trying to fix the problems wherever the problems are. But those are just my two cents.
Okay. I'm going to do a quick time check here.
Yes.
It's 10 after 2. We're not even doing 2:13. We're on slide 7 of 29.
Okay.
The committee has some important questions to ask, and that you guys are doing your best to answer well, which I appreciate. I know my co-chair has a question. I'm going to ask folks to hold questions a little bit, let us get it through a little bit more to see if some of our questions are answered, see what we can get through today. My expectation is we're going to have to ask you to come back again to talk about this, because none of us is happy about leaving money on the table when our budgets are so tight.
Understood.
Right? So, Mr. Co-Chair.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. First of all, I think it's important to put a perspective on all this collection, in that this isn't as if the Department of Revenue is the loan officer that created a loan and now is trying to collect on their work. This is a situation where it's been handed over to them, and they're doing the very best they can. And I guess I I'm of the opinion, I think folks show up to work on a daily basis and try and do their best to do collection. I guess with that said, what I need to understand is, how do we take employees who, again, are not compensated on
commission,
thank you. How do we keep them motivated? This is not fun work. Calling people to extract payment out of them is not fun. And so how do we keep them motivated to where...
Steve, you want to take that one?
Okay. To where they're showing up and saying, you know what, I'm going to do my very best for 8 hours to garner these dollars. I mean, I think I'd be good for about 4 days, and I'd be like, I'm done with this. Yeah. So that's one question I want to get my arms around. And then I think later you're going to give us a slideshow on what tools you have.
Right.
I would hope we'd hear not only here's our tools, but here's what we need in mm-hmm. addition mm-hmm. to make sure our hardworking folks have the tools they need to do the best they can. Absolutely. So I guess I'd love to hear, how do we keep these folks motivated to pick the phone up every day?
Well,
can you just identify yourself for the record?
Yes, day? I'm sorry. Chair Smith and Chair Steiner Hayward and members of the committee. My name is Steve Bouchard. I'm the section manager for the personal income tax collection section. I think that's a really hard question to answer in government employment. I think we do the best we can to describe the role and the mission and vision behind the role up front to employees and remind them the value in the work that they do and help the process take care of itself so that the work that they do each day, all day long, we can help them track the work that they're doing and explain to them the value in that, and be upfront about the type of task that they're involved in and make sure that that job is what they're after. Beyond that, an incentive or motivation, encourage, support, thank them, value them, and show them how the benefits of the work come to the state of Oregon.
So, as a follow-up, so are there benchmarks that each employee needs to meet?
There are performance expectations. There are statistics that we share and are transparent with for all staff. We have three classifications of collectors. Revenue agent ones, twos, and threes, with different skill sets from entry level all the way up to, and we have benchmarks for each thing that they do, from payment plans arranged, garnishment activity produced, inbound phone call expectations, outbound phone call expectations. Basically, everything that is, every ingredient to the job has an expectation behind it based on a reasonable factor.
Okay. Let's rock and roll.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. So, I'm going to skip over to the next slide, and I'm going to kind of I'll go over this one real quick. This is why most of this is to answer the question you had about why agencies might not use us. And some of the information we've received from agencies over the years is that, one, that they are not able to pass, and some agencies are not able to pass our charge onto the debtor like they can private collection firms. That commission that the 10 or 20 or 30% that the private collection firm charges, they can pass on to the debtor, and the debtor has to pay that. So otherwise,
don't
the state agency.
Sorry to interrupt. Don't have a provision because you need one statutorily, or don't have a provision?
Madam Chair, there is no statute that allows agencies to pass the collection fee on to the debtor. Mm-hmm. I know that there is from other agency accounts. Now, OJD, the Judicial Department, does have a statute. Employment Department just got one in 2013.
Okay.
Some agencies do. Some agencies have federal prohibitions against being able to pass either our fee or the private collection firm fee on. So there are some complexities around that, but that is anecdotally what we've heard from agencies over the years. Another thing, some agencies like to send the account to a private collection firm instead of OAA because they can sit on it longer. They can collect on it for up to three years or more. We have to return it after a year, so they have to handle it more often. And then historically, private collection firms have had more ability to invest in third-party data, where we're getting better at that now. And so we'll have more analytics and scoring, that kind of thing, too. So just real high level there. And
is then, that, I'm sorry, Mr. Fields, is that something that the Thomson Reuters stuff will be able to help with as well? Or Ms. Mack?
Madam Chair, I believe that we have been using LexisNexis since October of 14.
Right, that was the trial.
Mm-hmm.
And
No, this is for other agency accounts. I believe the trial you're talking about was Arm Insight and LexisNexis for the income tax side of the world. Again, this is the other agency accounts, and we actually entered into, I think, a contract with LexisNexis to get that data from them for other agency accounts.
Will we be able to use the Thomson Reuters?
And yes, Thomson Reuters for the court system, yeah.
Okay.
I'm going to hand it back over to Jim, and I'll continue driving.
Okay, so one of the other questions that you had went to the general categories of debt that's owed to DOR. And this slide shows a high-level look at the enforcement side of our business. Our tax debt accounts receivable is populated by four sources. First is self-assessed. These would be debts from people who file and acknowledge a debt that they can't pay right away. Audited, these are debts that come from, that's generated from our audit activity. Requests to file, these are debts from people who filed as a result of a notice from us saying, we think you need to file. And failure to file assessments are debts from people who we think should be filing, who refuse to file, and we generate an assessment on their behalf. So we talked about that earlier. The red receivables bucket is filled by these four blue faucets. And the level of enforced collections then is determined by two things. One, the rate of flow into the bucket from each of those four blue faucets, and two, ultimately, how fast we're able to drain the bucket through our collection efforts. On the filling the bucket side, we directly control the rate of the flow in all but the self-assessed faucet. That one's more directly controlled by the state of the economy. But the other three we do control, and we expect to see the biggest improvement to our business from the new system in both increasing the rate of flow into the bucket by these three faucets and in our ability to drain that bucket through our collections. And we'll go into this in more detail in a later slide. So this one of the questions we got went to the historic collection rates, both in dollar and percentage terms. And here we have the last 10 years, the most recent history of DOR collections in both those dollars and in collection rates. And I think I need to provide a little bit of context to help you understand what you're seeing here, in particular the variance that you're seeing from year to year. In 2010, you see a spike in both the dollars collected and in the collection rate. And that was primarily due to the amnesty program. In 2009, you passed legislation that allowed for income tax amnesty. And what that did was it allowed for a waiver of penalties and half of the interest that was due for taxpayers who voluntarily came forward to report and pay unpaid taxes. And the net result of that was an increase of $36 million, which increased the amount that we collected. So that's why you see the spike there in 2010. 2011, you see a drop in collections. And ironically, we believe that this is also attributable to the amnesty program. While a portion of that $36 million was almost certainly new money that we wouldn't have otherwise come in, it's almost certain that a portion of it was simply accelerated from future years. And you're seeing that, we think, in the 2011 collection numbers where it dropped back down. 2012 shows another increase in collected dollars and in the collection rate, and we believe that this is due at least in part to the quality of debt that we were receiving. The additions to our tax accounts receivable started to climb as the Great Recession hit. And during the early years of the recession, the biggest increase came from self-assessed debt. So these would be taxpayers who had some life event happen to them. Either the husband lost the job or the wife lost their job, and they got to tax time, and they filled out their tax return, and they realized they had a debt that they couldn't pay. But they filed anyway, and what they're saying is, Department of Revenue, we need for you to work with us to pay this off. These are generally taxpayers that are signaling to us that they want to be compliant but just can't. And so because these are taxpayers who want to be compliant, this is some of the easier debt for us to collect. And so that shows in the dollars and the rates. 2013 and 14, I think, reflects the other shoe. Over the last 2 years, the largest increase to our accounts receivable has shifted from self-assessed to filing enforcement debt. So these would be taxpayers who had the identical life event happen to them. The husband lost the job or the wife lost the job. But when they came to tax time, saw that they had a tax due, they chose not to file. And so they didn't, and it took a couple of years for us to catch up to them. In the course of our work, we have begun to catch up with them, and we've issued assessments for them. as opposed to the prior group that was signaling that they want to be compliant, these are folks that are signaling that they don't want to be compliant. And the filing enforcement debt is some of the more difficult debt for us to collect. And so that's, I think, reflected in the collection numbers. Another downward pressure on 2013 and 2014 has been the cuts to the IRS budget. Mm-hmm. As we mentioned in here before, the IRS shares their Oregon audits with us. And as the IRS budget has been cut, we've seen a significant drop in the IRS audits that have come our way. And these are typically easier for us to collect because the taxpayer generally knows that they owe the debt. They've already worked with the IRS on it, and now we're just getting our portion of that. And so the reduction in IRS audits has had an impact on our collection as well. And then lastly, one other thing that I need to mention about 2014, I think, is that it probably also reflects an impact from our core system replacement work. You gave us, at the beginning of 2014, you gave us 31 positions to support the system conversion. Yeah, but we didn't put any of these people into the project. What we did was we took people out of program and put them into project, because these are the people that understand both our legacy system and understand where we want to go. And so we took the people out of program. We asked people within program to step up and take those roles of leadership. And the positions that we wound up filling were those entry-level positions. So typically, the entry-level positions for the department wind up being the auditors and the collectors. Because we had a greater percentage of new staff than normal that needed to go through a training period, and because we used experienced staff to train them, we have seen a lag in production as a result, and I think that contributed to a lower number as well.
Senator Whitson.
Thank you. I think you may have just identified one of the problems. If you have your entry-level people doing your collection and auditing, what is the qualification necessary for that position?
Madam Chair, Senator Whitsett, these folks don't. Let me back up. It depends on if you're talking about the collectors or the auditors. The auditors have education requirements. The collectors do not. They both have experience requirements. And these have traditionally, since I've been at the Department of Revenue for 33 years, these have been the entry or the gateway positions into the Department of Revenue. We wind up losing a fair number of people in those particular areas to other areas of leadership within the department. We've called it for years our audit garden or our collection garden, because these are the people that populate the Department of Revenue. They get their feet wet into the processes of the Department of Revenue, and then they say, hey, I'd like to go work over in that other area. And then we wind up, those are the areas that we pull from the outside.
So the entry-level positions have minimal requirements, and those who are good at what they do get plucked out for other parts of the agency.
Madam Chair, Senator Whitsett, I think that's probably pretty accurate. I think that's pretty accurate for any large organization.
That would seem to not prioritize collections, but okay.
I think, Mr. Buchholz, you're sort of caught between a rock and a hard place. Right. I mean, I hear what you're saying, Senator Whitsett, and it struck me when you were explaining that, Mr. Buchholz, but you've got to make sure that your system works well, the transition, so that you can take advantage of all the new features when you do get the personal income tax side transferred over. But I share Senator Whitsett's concerns about the significant decline in the percent collections when you've got a significant amount of increased debt out there, and I think that worries all of us.
Madam Chair, it concerns me as well. I do need to point out that was not the single reason why we thought 2014. There was a number of different downward pressures on it, but it is absolutely a contributory factor.
No, I understand. I mean, I don't think there's a single thing in this presentation that's single factorial, right? I mean, these are all multifactorial problems.
Yeah.
But it points out some of the trade-offs that have to be made. There is not an infinite supply of experienced people, and therefore you can't automatically backfill the positions that you take away from collections to put into project work with experienced people, but on the other hand, we need experienced people to achieve the level of collections or at least mitigate that particular factor in declining rates of collection. So,
Madam Chair, agree.
Anyway. Okay, we've got about one more minute. Is this a good time for you to stop, or is there something else?
This would be a good place to stop.
This would be a good place to stop.
I think.
Mr. Boyle?
Yes. Yes, this would be a good place to stop.
Monday? Okay, yeah, okay. So we're going to want you back. I don't know when exactly because we're still, our schedule, this committee has had more schedule in flux than I can shake a stick at. That being said, tomorrow we have two work sessions that should be quick, I hope. And so, committee, if we can try really hard to be on time and get them done, do you want to try to have them come back tomorrow or not do that because it's too much? I don't know if you guys are available on short notice. Mm-hmm. Senator Whitsitt, did you have a question?
The House has a gun bill.
On Monday.
Monday.
That's what I was getting to next.
That's going to be a quick bill, though.
It's going to be a quick bill? Yeah. Sorry, Mr. Buchholz.
Madam Chair, Deanna can't come back tomorrow. She has a large portion of it. We can go through the parts that she doesn't have.
Nope. Then I know I'd like to have the two of you. You're a good team, and I'd like to have the two of you. We'll work together to figure out a mutually convenient time. Okay. So, committee, tomorrow, two work sessions. Get here quick, get out quick. And Monday, as Senator Whitsitt alluded to, it's my understanding that the House is doing Senate Bill 941 related to background checks, and that suggests that you all will be on the floor. I will ask everybody to remain flexible. We'll do exactly on Monday what we had thought we might do today, depending on schedule, which is stay in communication as much as possible, with Mr. Borden being our point person, and Representative Smith and I will stay closely connected. We will likely have to do some rearranging and catching up, folks, so we'll keep you posted on any schedule changes. Mr. Borden, anything else? Oh, yeah. Great. Okay. Mr. Borden reminds me that tomorrow the Supreme Court, the Oregon Supreme Court, intends to issue its PERS decision. And
oh God.
Yeah, that's our sentiments exactly.
8 a.m. Right?
8 a.m. Mm-hmm. Be there or be square and be prepared to, depending on your perspective, be overjoyed or really sad or both.
These poor people.
What?
More pressure on revenue.
I know. Totally not. You guys can go. I mean, seriously. I'm going to close the hearing on House Bill 5035, and thank you all very much. I am not adjourning the committee meeting yet. Just as one before I get to Senator Johnson, Mr. Borden reminds me that on March 16th was the day we heard the presentation on what might happen if the Supreme Court rules that the changes that we made in 2013 do not turn out to be constitutional and we have to regroup. So that budget information brief is in OLIS for March 16th. Senator Johnson.
Take me off.
Okay, good. Anything else?
Taylor. Thank you, Chair Senator Hayward. So regarding the report, the LFO report they were referring to earlier in the where is that?
March 16th.
No, not the March 16th, but the one they're referring
to. Just resend it to members of the committee.
We'll resend it. Now.
Yeah, but the one that they were talking about in their presentation.
Oh, their
revenue was talking about in the presentation. They said the LFO report.
Okay, Madam Co-Chair, yeah. That's the liquidated and liquid account for 2014 that is already on the legislative fiscal website under publications. But I'd be
no, that's fine. I just want to know it's under publications.
On the LFO website?
LFO.
Okay.
And it's 2013-14. 2014. Okay.
Okay. Any other business before the committee? Okay. Any other business before the